Hello, this is Sean Kennedy. I'm the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Nursing. And I'm speaking today with Dr. Susan Loeb, who is an associate professor and director of the PhD program in the College of Nursing at Pennsylvania State University in University Park, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you. I'm so excited to be here today and to have the opportunity to speak with you in this podcast.
Well, thank you for taking the time, and also thank you for this really wonderful article. The article that Susan and her associate, Rachel Wyon, who's a PhD candidate at Penn State, wrote for us in the March issue is End of Life Care Behind Bars, a Systematic Review. And the article, as indicated, is a systematic review of looking at the research literature on end-of-life care in prisons. In order to determine what the current state of the science is and to look at suggestions for nursing practice and areas for future research. When I was reading the manuscript when you first sent it in, what piqued my interest, Susan, was the number of older prisoners, the older inmates that are in prison. And one of the statistics that struck me was that there were two, actually. One was that the percentage of inmates ages 54 and older nearly tripled from 1991 to 2011, and that by the end of 2013, there were over 250,000 inmates 50 years or older in U.S. prisons. And, of course, caring for aging prisons' health needs also means caring for people who, have chronic illnesses or terminal illnesses and then come to end of life. And we don't often think of prisoners, prisons as places of hospices. And then one leads to wonder, well, who is taking care of these people? Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting to me that much of the care is being done by fellow inmates. But before we get into some of the key points of your article, could you talk a little bit first about how you got interested in this particular population?
Sure, I'd love to. This harkens back in time, and just to give you a bit of context, back when I was a practicing nurse, I worked in a small community hospital that cared for a number of inmates, middle-aged to older adult typically, and when we got these folks in the small community hospital was when the medical care needs exceeded the capacity of the prison infirmary. Mm-hmm. So this small town and probably 90-bed hospital cared for patients from two fairly large state correctional institutions that were within that town. And so that was my first encounter with caring for the inmate population. Now, back at that time, I was, not even thinking about advanced degrees and, having any kind of research program or anything. But I will say that it allowed me, when an opportunity came about, to have something to hang my hat on. So although I had not worked in prisons, I had cared for many, many prisoner patients in the hospital setting. And later, whenever I was a master's prepared nurse and was doing clinical teaching, I actually took my students to that particular hospital, my baccalaureate students, and supervised undergraduate students, traditional ones, taking care of inmate patients. I was teaching a nursing care of the middle-aged adult course, and at that point in time, one of the main ways that I was able to capture somebody within the age parameters and of the course was to take care of inmate patients. And it was a really good exposure for the students. Some have gone on, not large numbers, but some have gone on to work in correctional settings. And then let's move forward in time to about probably 2004 when I accepted a tenure line position here at Penn State. I was looking to for a way to focus my research. My background was gero, and I had focused on health promotion and community living elders and chronic disease management in that same community, but was really trying to hone down to maybe a more specific niche that I could make a unique contribution to. And when working with some consultants that were, helping me with this as a new tenure line faculty person, I you know, I brought up the idea, what do you think of really focusing on the aging inmate population? I have, you know, some interesting background in caring for them in the community, and attended a couple enrichment programs. One was an NIA Summer Institute, another was a Hartford sponsor program where I, you know, developed a proposal and was able to link up with a sociologist at Penn State. And after some important pilot work, we had I had my first research funded as a PI that focused on the aging inmate population and how they manage chronic conditions and what kind of health-promoting behaviors they engaged in. And that kind of started the ball in motion, and that was probably probably 11 or 12 years ago.
Wow, that's really interesting. And the thing that I really liked about how you positioned the systematic review was looking at, you know, several different questions, not just about how the care is described in the research literature, but also looking at how stakeholders view end-of-life care for those dying in prison. And I was fascinated by how the caregivers, you know, how they're picked and, you know, how they get trained, and then their involvement and how they perceive their role and what happens in their perception and their feelings when the person that they're caring for dies. That was, I thought, was really fascinating, and it really seemed to be something that really humanized prisoners and the prison experience.
I agree, and I'm glad that that came through, Sean, because our current and recent research work has really focused on end-of-life care in the prison setting and enhancing end-of-life care in those settings because, you know, there's many a good number of prisons now, certainly upper double digits, you know, without having a precise count, but there's still many, many prisons that could use, you know, use this kind of service and don't have anything yet, and we've witnessed that. And so I think that getting this word out is important. I think that realizing that no matter who we are or where we live, that having, you know, a modicum of respect, dignity, and hope at the end of life is important. And some have described this population as the least among us, and being particularly vigilant for folks that are vulnerable, perhaps don't engender a lot of public sympathy, and realizing, too, the importance of those inmate peer caregivers to the success of some of these programs and how much of a difference there's potential that it can make a real difference, not just for the person who's facing end of life, but also for those who are attending to them in those, you know, final, you know, whatever years, 6 months, weeks, towards the end.
Yeah, when you I mean, one of the things that I got a sense of in reading the article was that I mean, prison is so, which we know is so isolating, but that the sense I got is that so many of these people, the people that end up in prison are people who probably had failed relationships or families or dysfunctional, you know, upbringings and somehow never made a real connection in caring for someone. And that this kind of, and you brought that out, that this, one of the perceptions for the caregiver was that this kind of gave them a second chance or was kind of a vindication or a way of kind of, you know, evening out some of the reason that they were ended up in prison. It was a way of kind of giving back, so to speak. Do you know, one of the things I was thinking might be interesting as a future research for your next article for us, I wonder if prisons that do have programs like this, if there's a difference in the amount of, you know, violence or disruption that occurs in the prison when you have people who are invested in this type of a program.
I think that would be a fascinating study to undertake, and I've seen anecdotal, you know, reports about the climate, the within a prison. There's potential there that this kind of program can build trust or inspire trust in relationships between, you know, prisoner patients and the folks who are charged with taking care of them in terms of the professional ranks, not inmate peers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in both directions. I think that it affords the opportunity for the prison staff, particularly frontline ones, to look at inmates in a bit of a different light when working side by side with them in caring for those who, you know, who are in need. And then the reverse also, because in the prison there's, you know, numerous, what do I want to say, foci in terms of care, custody, and control, and care is not necessarily always, you know, probably right. isn't number one. And so there can be a degree, and probably often is a degree of suspicion with which those inmate patients receive, receive their care. And certainly people are people, and there's variation right. from caregiver to caregiver. But I think that there can be definite bonuses, you know, positive impacts there. And then also within the general prison population, if they see that, you know, end-of-life care is working for their peers and that there's humanity there, and I think that can build trust. Mm-hmm. And, I think you could have impacts beyond the yeah. infirmary and beyond those that are directly touched by the program, being the, you know, the recipients right. or the providers.
Was there anything, after doing this literature review, was there anything that you were surprised by?
Nothing immediately is coming to mind, mm-hmm. but probably the biggest thing is that how much we still don't know, that we don't know basically much of anything about the families of folks who are receiving care in prison. So if you reflect off of hospices in the community and how much attention is given to family members, both while their family member or important, significant other is in those final stages of life, as well as after death has occurred, mm-hmm. I think there is a really important gap. Also, I think the fact that we don't know so much about, you know, nurses, professional nurses on a whole, because I know we really were looking for more about them, and they weren't, you know, oftentimes bubbling to the surface as we might have anticipated that they would, since they're probably the predominant frontline care provider with these folks beyond, you know, chaplaincy and the peers.
Mm. That's a great point about the caregiver, the families of the prisoner who's at end of life, because because of the disruption in the relationship in prison and probably other family dynamics. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know how hard it is on the grieving family when they have been able to grieve or be with the person. So to have these barriers of prison and perhaps, you know, unmet resolution of lots mm-hmm. of issues, that's probably a really ripe area for research in terms of how those people move forward, and children and, you know, spouses mm-hmm. and children and all the families and mm-hmm. what that means for their own perception of, you know, what care is and end-of-life care, et cetera. So.
And the complexity of all that, and the complexity of even if there is a desire to stay in touch, and, you know, let's assume crimes weren't against one's own family, which in many cases it's not, but oftentimes inmates are purposefully positioned, say, in a state far away from their home, which also raises challenges to families perhaps that would like to stay in touch or maybe make visits. Maybe they don't have the wherewithal, you know, to forge across the state of, you know, a large state, or to maintain contact even if they would like to do so.
Yeah. Well, it certainly raises a lot of really interesting questions. And, again, thank you for submitting this to AJN. We hope many of our readers will read this either online or iPad or in old-fashioned print, and to look for a blog, and we'll certainly be putting this out on social media, because we think it is an important article and one that has not been really looked at sufficiently. So thank you again, Susan, for bringing this to our attention and to our readers.
Oh, you're welcome, and it's been my pleasure.